Reverend Cooper, Rail 5.
The next event really was our move from Goose Green to Bluff Cove. Before that move took place, the weather got quite cold. It did freeze. It with a sprinkling of snow, and quite clearly winter was well and truly on the way. In the meantime, I had one last dealing with this Argentine chaplain, who contacted me and asked if he could go back to his accommodation to pick up his clerical things. But it didn't seem to me to be unreasonable, so I asked him where it was, and he said, well, it's at the schoolmaster's house. Well, I knew that the schoolmaster's house was out of the settlement, as was the school, and we weren't clear about any mines. So I said to him, well, what about mines? And he said, oh, it's all right, I know the way. So I just checked with Chris Keeble that he'd no objection, and he said no, he hadn't, and I went with this chaplain and my signaller. And the Argentine chaplain simply walked along the shingle beach and as far as he could to his level with the house, and then turned left up a small creek and walked up to the house. And the only thing that rather concerned me was, despite his assurance that there were no mines there, there were one or two suspicious looking craters along the beach, and I did have my suspicions. But since he walked first and I made quite sure I put my feet in his footsteps, I was at least tried to do something to allay my anxiety. But we heard of the move to Fitzroy initially, and this of course was a consequence of John Crossland ringing through on the islanders' own telephone line to both Fitzroy and Bluff Cove to ask whether there were any Argentines there, and of course he was assured that there weren't. And the battalion hijacked the one flying Chinook, stuffed I think a couple of companies into it, about 80 soldiers into it, and flew it off to Fitzroy. I was warned in the evening that I'd be flying with the RAP, but in the event we didn't go that evening, and we flew the next morning with the remainder of the battalion in a Sea King, we actually bypassed Fitzroy. By this time it had been realised that Bluff Cove itself was free, and we flew on to Bluff Cove where we were dropped, and we, the RAP, took up our residence in a small shed just outside the just a short distance away from the house where the Kilmartins at Bluff Cove lived. It started to rain, and it seemed to rain then permanently for about the next 3 days. The Kilmartins were very helpful and opened their store of steaks, as far as I could see, and really seemed to set about with the intention of giving every soldier in Tupar that was in Bluff Cove a steak or two. Well, after a while it became quite clear that if I was going to get warmed up in any way, the best place would be by the Arga where they were cooking these steaks. So I went and volunteered to take on the cooking, which seemed to be gratefully accepted. And so I spent quite a while cooking steaks for the soldiers, and it just seemed that the Kilmartins had got an inexhaustible supply of meat, and I had no idea where it was coming from. But they kept bringing the meat, I kept cooking it, and there always seemed to be more soldiers who were ready to eat it. And as far as I was concerned, not only was I warm, I was drying out, and it was quite a pleasant interlude. The Kilmartins couldn't do enough for us. They let us use their dining room table as an operating table for some of the casualties. We had a soldier who'd had a shot through the foot that hadn't really been treated, and he was treated there. They were they couldn't do enough for us. We slept in the shed, and during the first night we could hear artillery rounds landing some distance away, but they sounded quite heavy. And we did wonder whether they were some of the 150mm guns that we knew the Argentines had. We knew we were out of range from them, and unless they decided to tow them down the road from Stanley. But I did hear afterwards that they were generally in our D company's positions, who were the company that were out, as it were, on the Stanley Road. Our B company were back at Bluff Cove, and the next day I walked back to see them, and I left most of my kit with the RAP, And I walked back, and the bridge spanning a small sort of estuary or inlet between Bluff Cove and Fitzroy had been, well, the Argentines had attempted to blow it, but they hadn't been entirely successful. It was a wooden structure, perhaps 15 to 20 feet above the water's surface at its highest point, and all the Argentines had succeeded in doing was blowing off some of the wooden cross members, leaving the main members, which spanned the river, intact. And I found for a gap of about 30 to 40 feet, maybe slightly more, I had to walk along the cross members, which were about a foot wide. It wasn't a particularly difficult crossing. And that the route back to Fitzroy was not too far, 6-7 miles, and entirely passable. 9 Squadron were clearing mines from the approaches to the bridge, and indeed had cleared them. They'd got them stacked at the side of the track. And I got back to B Company, who seemed in good heart, and spent that night with them, simply slept in front of the fire. The next day, I went back to Bluff Cove, and it was pouring with rain. I recrossed the estuary, and in fact caught up with our provost sergeant and his provost staff, who were heading back to Bluff Cove. When I got there, I found that the Scots Guards had arrived, and I didn't know how they'd got there, or at that time I didn't know how they'd got there or how long they'd been there, but they looked like a defeated army. They were wet, they were miserable, they were unhappy, and seemed really thoroughly out of sorts. And when I got to our main headquarters, I discovered that the Scots Guards were replacing us, and we were actually dropping back to Fitzroy, where we'd be the reserve battalion. At the same time, a troop of Blues and Royals had turned up. They were going back to Fitzroy, so I hitched a lift with them. There was a bit of discussion amongst them over whether it was safe to carry troops on them in case of air attack, but they finally decided that we could. And I sat on the radiator cowl, which was initially very comfortable, but after a few miles, it began to get a bit too hot to be entirely comfortable, but by then I was committed. There wasn't really anywhere else I could go. But we went on with via these vehicles back to Fitzroy, arrived there after some hours, since they obviously couldn't cross the bridge, so they'd got about a 20-mile journey. And we settled in at Fitzroy, where I again remained with the RAP. We dug trenches in case we needed them. And I stayed with the RAP in a building that I think was owned by the estate manager, and as the Fire Brigade Reserve, we didn't anticipate that there'd be a great deal really for us to do other than prepare ourselves for whatever our next task was. I got some of the soldiers to go fishing in the hope that we could get some fresh food that way. Some of the islanders by this time had given us some bread, which was the first bread I'd had, I think, probably since about Sierra Leone. It was quite a long time. On the whole, life seemed fairly comfortable. We'd one or two casualties coming in from suffering from trench foot, but that was about all. Until one day when the dawn came, and with it we saw the Galahad in the bay. And Steve Hughes, our doctor, and I were quite surprised to find this ship there in daylight. And as we walked out of the community centre that by this time we were using as a sort of the treatment area for casualties, even private soldiers were running a book on how long it would be before the Galahad was bombed. And sure enough, within minutes, it seemed, we had an air warning read before anybody could react to it. The aircraft were over us. The Galahad was bombed. The only fire, really, I think, that was put up against these aircraft came from the snipers that I'd sent to go fishing. And I think the story of the Galahad's fairly well known. What had surprised me most, other than the fact that the ship was there, was to discover that there were men still on it in daylight. And that seemed to us all at that time almost sort of criminal irresponsibility. We had an argument with the commanding officer of the field ambulance that was on the Galahad, who said he was taking over the building that we were in for casualties. Well, that was fine, except there was nowhere for us to go, and he certainly hadn't cleared that with our battalion. So we were having an argument about this, telling him he ought really to go and clear it with our battalion headquarters. And until he did, we certainly weren't going to move. And as he outlined his scheme, he was talking about the medical facility not really being ready for about 4 days, 4 or 5 days. And I couldn't believe that anybody with any experience would leave an area without a medical facility at that stage of the battle for such a long time. And again, it seemed quite clear that he simply hadn't grasped the nature of the conflict. Well, the situation was taken out of his hands, because when the Galahad went up, his field hospital went with it. And he'd really very little to offer anybody anyway. In the event, as the Galahad went up, Steve Hughes pushed the casualties that we'd got in this centre out and just told them basically to pick up the beds and walk, and they'd have to find somewhere else. None of them were anything more than trench foot. And we then set off to see what we could do to help the survivors. Steve went down to the seashore, and I didn't actually see him again. I grabbed a defence platoon from 9 Squadron, Royal Engineers, and as the helicopters arrived, I organised the stretchers from the helicopter back to the village hall, where such medics as were about did what they could for them and performed some sort of triage, after which I then shoved them on a helicopter to go back to Ajax Bay, where they'd obviously get more treatment. And we did this for some time, until the flow of casualties coming off the Galahad began to reduce and eventually stopped. The next thing that caught my attention was, as I walked around a corner, I ran into a figure coming the other way who'd obviously come off the Galahad, and he was soaking wet. He'd got a blanket round him, and he was Chinese. And I just couldn't believe it. And I where are you from? And of course, he was one of the Lascars who were the crew of the Fleet Auxiliary. And it just didn't cross my mind that, you know, that the conflict would sort of involve people of that type. And I don't know why it should, but it did. It shook me at the time. Here was this poor bloke from the other side of the world, nothing to do with him, and he was swimming for it and sort of fetched up ashore, soaking wet. And behind him were large numbers of other survivors who were uninjured. By this time, five brigade headquarters who were co-located seemed to have closed down completely, and there was no decision coming from them about anything. So I took the casualties, the survivors, and sat them under a hedge, and increasing numbers of them, and sat them under a hedge, and told them that I'd fly them back to Ajax Bay as soon as I'd got the helicopters available, but at the moment the helicopters were still taking back the Burns casualties. Soldiers began to appear amongst them, Welsh guards, most of whom seemed to have been stunned into inactivity. I saw platoon commanders and senior NCOs who really were too dazed to be able to make a great deal of the situation, and I simply sat them down with the remainder of the survivors. The company commander then arrived and introduced himself as a company commander. So I said, right, well, your survivors are over by that hedge, and I reckon you've lost the better part of your mortars platoon. Now, he immediately disagreed and said, no, nothing of the sort, the casualties were very light, and that they would soon re-equip. So I said, well, what are you going to re-equip from? And he said, well, we've got a lot of stuff on the ship. To which I said, well, have you seen the ship? And it became clear that he too simply hadn't grasped the situation. So I told him to go and start doing something by way of determining who his casualties were, because I was going to send all the survivors back, since they were no use to anybody where we were, and indeed would be a drain on such resources as we'd got. And indeed I did. As soon as all the casualties had been flown out, I then flew the survivors out, both the seamen and military, and amongst them went, as far as I could tell at the time, such remainders of the Welsh Guard support company who hadn't been injured, and they went back to Ajax Bay. And as far as I'm aware, they went back entirely on my decision, because there was nobody else around who seemed to be making one. And Five Brigade itself were in a shed, and it did seem to me that to them the rest of the world didn't exist, and certainly the disaster that was going on outside the door made no impact on them whatsoever, and they simply weren't interested. So I sent the Welsh Guards back, and for us, I suppose it became a turning point. I mean, prior to that, the feeling amongst our soldiers had really been quite clearly had been one of we've done our bit. You know, it would be nice to let somebody else win a few of the medals. And then after this, there was a real turn of the feeling, and our soldiers were saying, let's just get on and get it finished. And if it means casualties, well, okay, but we can't hang around like this. And if we leave it to everybody else, it's just going to be a repetition of this. And there certainly became a very firm determination on our soldiers that the best course of action was simply to press on and to make the most of it. I had another brief visit to Bluff Cove itself before we actually left, and met there some Polish seamen. It seemed that a Polish ship had been in Stanley Harbour, and these seamen had left the ship and asked for political asylum. But before a great deal could be done about it, the Argentines had arrived, and these seamen found themselves at Bluff Cove. And they'd certainly made themselves useful. One of them took me down to the bay and showed me a small dam he'd made, which flooded at high tide, and then at low tide, as the water receded, it left fish behind that had swum in over the dam but had not swum out. And this again seemed to be a fairly major source of food for them, and they gave us some of the fish, which were most welcome. But the Scots Guards had moved in there and made themselves at home, and our next move really was by helicopter back to the Commando Brigade north to the back of Mount Kent. And I really was quite glad to see the back of both Fitzroy and Bluff Cove. Not because I had anything against the people there, but simply because the whole business seemed to be one entirely the consequence of ineptitude and military mismanagement. And I just didn't want to be associated with that kind of incompetence. I think that was a feeling that was quite common within the battalion. So once we got back to the Commando Brigade, we were happy that at least we were with an organisation that that seemed to be thinking along the lines that we would expect that kind of organisation to be. And we got to the back of Mount Kent around about, I suppose in my case, about midday. And we knew that evening we would be supporting the Commando attack on Twin Sisters and Three Paras attack on Mount Longdon, which would involve in quite a long approach march. But we did have time to have a brew, some food, get our heads down and have a few hours sleep. And then, as night fell, we began to move, and we each took two or three mortar rounds, a couple of miles probably, no more, from where it had been dumped down to our mortar line. And then we set off really behind, I think it was 4-2 Commando, but I may be wrong over that, whichever Commando it was, attacked Twin Sisters and Three Para, in case they needed us. I didn't really think that they would, but obviously we were there to support them should it be needed. It was a bitterly cold night, really very, very cold, and as we walked, soldiers were falling out continually, suffering from acute diarrhoea, and were finding it impossible really to keep going any length of time without having to stop and relieve themselves. One or two of the soldiers who'd been brought in to fill in numbers seemed to find the going difficult, and one, I think it was a catering corps member, fell out completely, and we carried his rucksack for him, his Bergen, to keep him going. But by midnight or thereabouts, the early hours of the morning, we reached a lying up point where we lay down in a scrape in the ground and simply froze. It was the coldest time I'd up until then ever known, bitterly cold. But we had no sleeping bags, we had no ground sheets, we simply had the clothes we stood up in, and we had to put up with it. It wasn't too bad once we got moving again, at least we warmed up. But whilst we were lying there, the cloud base dropped and we found ourselves in cloud, freezing, it was snowing on and off, and we could hear helicopters. It's hardly right to say flying by, it seemed that they were going by more or less with their skids on the ground. Has been about the only way they could progress, because the weather was so thick and they were simply literally no more than a foot off the ground, just creeping forward and lifting over fences, dropping down and then creeping forward again. We could hear the attack on Twin Sisters and we started moving. We moved forward. The weather cleared, it stayed very cold but it became quite a clear night, and we actually had a very good view of Three Paras attack on Longdon, which really seemed to be quite a spectacular fireworks display. We got to an area just short of Longdon by dawn, and the track itself went straight ahead round Longdon and on to Stanley. We turned off to the left. The track was being shelled, and as we moved round to the essentially moved north before going east towards the Firsbush Pass, I think it was probably the Murrell Bridge where we turned left, we came under sporadic artillery fire. But it was interesting to see those again who'd not been at Goose Green and therefore didn't have our experience, reacting in exactly the same way that we had when it had been new to us. And the first sound of an artillery round sort of leapt into the ditch at the side of the track. But they fairly quickly got accustomed to it. And once the sun was up and beginning to warm us slightly, the battalion had come to a halt in the Firsbush Pass area, where we were told we'd be staying for at least the next 24 hours. What we hadn't appreciated, by we I mean those of us with the RAP, was that the bulk of the battalion was a good 2 kilometres away, that we'd been towards the tail, and nobody seemed to have realised how far back we were. The headquarter company commander found us and was happy that we stayed where we were, but did warn us that there were possibilities of Argentine heli-borne attacks, and that should there be one, we might well be the first group of the battalion that these Argentines might bump into. There was a sapper troop quite close by us, so I liaised with them and we established our arcs of defence and arcs of fire and where we'd put our sentries. And when I went back to the RAP, I said that there was this possibility of a heli-borne attack. We were tired and that I thought it would probably be a good idea if we doubled the sentries. This was immediately thought of as a good idea, so our sentries that night were doubled. Nothing happened except that it was an extraordinarily cold night again, and again we'd no sleeping bags or ground sheets, so we simply lay out, covered ourselves as best as we could with the sort of heather ling that was growing there, and simply froze. We huddled together for warmth. It didn't seem that we were very warm until my signaller got up to go and do his stag on sentry, and I suddenly realised how much warmer he had kept me. But it was bitterly cold, and when dawn came we were really quite relieved to see it. We were then called to an OO group, and it wasn't until we went forward to main headquarters that we realised just how far we were. Of course we arrived therefore late, we got a bollocking for that, but I don't think anybody at the battalion end had realised how distant we were. And we were given the orders for the attack that night on Wireless Ridge by the CO, David Chandler, who joined us just before we left Goose Green, but had actually taken over from Chris Keeble when we were in Bluff Cove. He gave us the orders, and Steve Hughes and I looked at the map, saw that the RAP was on a forward slope in direct view of the enemy, And we looked at each other and said, you know, we're not going to survive this battle. There's no way we can be where we are, showing light, which we needed to do to see the casualties, and not expect the Argentine positions to notice it. And we were really not sure quite what to do about this. It did seem a suicidal position. And we decided that we'd take the match up with Chris Keeble. And before we actually did that, we were told that the attack was postponed for 24 hours, since it had proved impossible for the artillery to produce their fire plan, which would have to be in conjunction with us and the Scots guards who were attacking Tumbledown at the same night. So the attack was postponed for 24 hours, and this would give not only us an extra 24 hours to prepare, but also give our company commanders time to go to Three Para and from Mount Longdon look onto the ground that we would be attacking over. This actually proved to be a benefit, because it turned out that one feature which Three Para had reported as that they'd secured, and which indeed was protecting our right flank, turned out to have not been secured and still have an Argentine company on it. So at quite short notice, David Chandler changed his plan so that this Argentine company could be dealt with before we then moved on to attack Wireless Ridge proper. And as part of that change of plan, the location of the RAP was also altered, much to the relief of Steve Hughes and I, who felt that the new position was a much sounder position on a reverse slope, where we'd at least have some chance of seeing casualties and not necessarily being seen by the Argentines as we were doing it. We were due to move off that night. We were to have had a ration resupply, which by some mistake went to A Company. When we found ourselves without any rations and discovered what had happened, I went and found Der Farah Hockley, who was commanding A Company, and explained the situation. He whipped round his soldiers and recovered the rations, less all the chocolate. And to be fair to him, he then came along himself to the RAP and said, "Look, you know, I've got the rations I can. I'm afraid the chocolate's gone. That's the way it is. But sorry about that." No, couldn't ask for more than that. We'd got our rations. And that night we began our approach march. It was very difficult, as I remember it, very difficult going. The ground was very uneven, very peaty, it was slow, and took us quite a while to get to where the RAP was to be, which was slightly short of the start line, and we got there and dug in. And actually, it was probably an inactive battle, or at least first part of the battle, for us. The attack went quite successfully. We had the Blues and Royals in support, which made a huge difference. We've got quite a lot of artillery helping us. And I think the only real problem we had was that until the Scots Guards began their attack on Tumbledown, we had the undivided attention of the Argentine artillery. So we were quite keen that the Scots Guards should begin their attack as soon as possible. But for us at the RAP, it meant initially a trickle of casualties, not by any means many, and indeed the